Iran welcomes the Arab League's decision to readmit Syria into the bloc, saying this follows Syria's great victory over terrorists. The U.S. president renews his call for a national assault weapons ban and other gun safety measures in the wake of a mass shooting in Texas that claimed 8 lives. And recession fears mounting in Germany as official data shows drops in manufacturing, energy and construction in Europe's top economy. And welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned into World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran has hailed the Arab League's decision to readmit Syria into the body 12 years after the country's suspension. The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says this followed Syria's great victory over terrorists and the support Syrians gave to their government. Nasser Kanani said Tehran welcomes the fact that regional countries have settled differences in a move that curbs foreign interventions. Now, the spokesman said Tehran hopes that regional countries will further strengthen cooperation based on shared interests. Earlier, Russia also welcomed the readmission, which it has called a long-awaited step. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also commended Syria's return to the Arab League. It called on Muslim countries to strengthen bonds of friendship and counter Israel's expansionist projects. Political commentator Tim Anderson is of the opinion that Arab countries want to reassert their influence in the region in some new ways now that the war on Syria has failed.
So there are contradictions in that. There are contradictions in the Bahraini regime, the UAE, in their normalization. But at the same time, they reestablish relations with Syria. They want to be relevant. That's really what's driven this. They don't want to be left out. They see that the dirty war on Syria has failed. And all of those states want to have reassert their influence in some new ways in the new reality of the region. That's what's going on. But they can't just immediately abandon all of the relations they've had with the U.S. After all, they've acted in U.S. interests for many, many years. And it's going to be interesting to see how they try and disentangle themselves from this relationship, because, of course, the U.S. is not, it may be a declining power, but it's not harmless. It's capable of doing some real damage, particularly to its collaborators, which are seen to betray them or go in a different direction. We've seen what they've done with collaborators in many other countries in the past.
Iran's top general Mohammad Baqiri says there are new signs of a shift in the global balance of power from west to east. Oh, the chief of general staff of Iranian armed forces says the U.S. has been trying to impose itself as the absolute ruler of the world, but the new shift hints at a future that belongs to Asia. Major General Mohammad Baqiri also called for defense cooperation with Oman and invited the country to join the international marine drills Iran holds in the region. Baqiri was speaking during a meeting with his Omani counterpart, Vice Admiral Abdullah bin Khamis al-Raisi. And the Omani official said regional solidarity leads to security. He added that regional disagreements should not become a reason for foreign interventions. Now, the families of a group of Iranians captured by the Mojahedin Khaq terror organization MKO have gathered in front of the Red Cross office in Tehran. They demand the immediate release of their loved ones who have been held by the terrorists for decades.
Today is the day of International Committee of the Red Cross. On this occasion, some families have gathered here and they're demanding to see their loved ones who are trapped in the MEK in camps in Albania. And the most basic human rights of these people inside their camps is abused, and including not being able to contact the outside world, particularly the families. And they are demanding that the Red Cross would use all its capacity, trying to force Albanian government and other international bodies to try to make some connection between these people and the people inside the camps. Some of them haven't heard about their loved ones for more than 40 years now. And this is a very grave suffering. And we have tried for many years to just make contact. They just want a simple call or a letter or being able to visit their loved ones. That's all. And to learn that if they are safe and sound.
The U.S. president has once again called on Congress to move to curb access to guns following the mass shooting at a mall in Texas over the weekend. Joe Biden is seeking a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Biden also called for universal background checks and an end to immunity for gun manufacturers. On Saturday, a gunman went on a shooting spree at a busy mall north of the city of Dallas, killing 8 people and injuring 7 others. This comes as reports say the social media accounts of the shooter contain hundreds of posts with racially or ethnically motivated content and violent far-right rhetoric. The reports say the Dallas resident may have been linked to a white supremacist or neo-Nazi group. Now, the UK's anti-monarchists have criticized the heavy-handed policing of King Charles III's coronation. They say there is no longer a right to peaceful protests in Britain after dozens of protesters were arrested and detained into the night. The detainees included Graham Smith, who leads the anti-monarchy group known as the Republic. In a statement, Smith said his arrest was predetermined and would have occurred regardless of any evidence or action. He added that the arrests were not about protecting people from harm, but about protecting the king from embarrassment. London's Metropolitan Police said a total of 64 arrests were made during Coronation Day protests. The detainees' charges included breach of the peace and conspiracy to cause a public nuisance.
The one-of-a-kind, multi-billion-pound coronation is finally coming to an end. A 3-day ceremony which saw King Charles III crowned along with his wife Camilla. More than 2,000 guests, including world leaders, aristocrats, and celebrities, all participated in the event. Tens of thousands of people flooded the streets in London to see King Charles III formally crowned. Thousands saw the king receiving a royal salute from members of the military in the gardens of Buckingham Palace following his coronation. The coronation of King Charles III in London's historic Westminster Abbey was the first in the United Kingdom for 7 decades. Heavy police presence overshadowed the wealthy event. The London Metropolitan Police deployed more than 11,000 officers for one of their biggest ever security operations for the day of the coronation. For many, the coronation of King Charles III was maybe a lifetime event full of joy and days-long festivities as tens of thousands turned out to catch a glimpse of the newly crowned King Charles and Queen Camilla, who rode in a state coach back to Buckingham Palace after Saturday services at Westminster Abbey. But not everyone who came to watch the multi-billion-pound ceremony was there to cheer Charles. Thousands of people poured onto the streets to protest against the antiquated monarchical system.
Not my king! Not my king! Not my king!
My king! Not my king! Not my king!
Because I don't believe in hereditary monarchy, and I think this is costing a huge amount of money when lots of people are struggling, and the economy is falling apart, and the public services are awful, and we need to invest in that and not in Charles and his big party.
London's Metropolitan Police said in total, over 60 arrests were made on Saturday for what it called offences including breach of the peace and conspiracy to cause a public nuisance. Those detained include leader of an anti-monarchist group, the Republic. Graham Smith criticised the policing of the coronation as heavy-handed, saying the arrests were not about protecting people from harm, but about protecting the kingdom from embarrassment.
The coronation comes at a time when Britain is grappling with numerous economic woes. This includes record-high inflation that has led to months of strikes and protests. With many Brits struggling to make ends meet, the government is spending taxpayer money on a multi-million pound state ceremony.
The coronation of King Charles III comes as there is no budget revealed for the historic national state occasion. Some suggest that the ceremony could cost the nation between 50 to 100 million pounds. The government has so far refused to comment on the exact cost, making the amount of public funds spent on the festivities unknown. What is known, though, is that the multi-million pound coronation falls to taxpayers to foot the bill. Not only that, the coronation comes at a time when the country is gripped with protests and strikes in a dispute with the government over pay. Since last June, a huge number of workers have walked off their jobs, including teachers, civil servants, train and bus drivers, border officials and university staff, nurses, ambulance drivers, and staff at swaths of government agencies just to express that they can't literally make ends meet. With several waves of strikes sweeping the UK, the economy has been hit harder than initially expected. The UK inflation has experienced a 40-year high. That includes food prices, with some key ingredients seeing a steep rise of up to 50%, according to some detailed government data. The situation is to the extent where many people across the country are struggling to put food at the table. Furthermore, the UK financial woes have exacerbated the economic and social inequality there. That has prompted many to question the costly pomp and pageantry associated with the state-funded ceremony. A survey prior to the coronation showed that most of the British people simply did not want to pay for the costly event, and instead, they wanted the coronation to be funded by the royal family itself. Anti-monarchy activists say the cost is a slap in the face for millions of people who are struggling to meet their basic needs. Yet, they have to foot the bill in the form of taxes. Maybe that's why many across Britain see the monarchy as outdated and undemocratic, saying the coronation is a celebration of hereditary power and has no place in modern society. Maybe that's why many are worried that the coronation of a 74-year-old man will indirectly result in so many people going hungry.
Well, former British lawmaker Limbit Opik believes that the government has politicised the right to protests in the country.
The Black Lives Matter demonstrations again clearly broke the law, clearly broke the lockdown regulations, but apparently that didn't really matter. Meanwhile, those who are objecting, for example, to the mandatory vaccines, and it begins to look like they may have had a point, they were criticised. They were written off as racists and extremists and things like that. And looking at Extinction Rebellion, a bunch of fundamentalist anarchists, they can block central London for days on end, and even potentially cause a situation where people's lives are harmed or even ended because the emergency services can't get through, but that's all right too. In terms of the anti-monarchist demonstrations that you've described, it's almost as if the state is saying, you can be a Republican, but you can't tell anyone about it. In a free country, we should be willing to tolerate different points of view rather than simply oppress the right to say it. And incidentally, the same is true of the British media. The British media goes along with this as well. And anybody who thinks the BBC is impartial only needs to look at what they've said about the environment. Wherever you stand on it, there should be a right to protest about the mainstream. But instead, we now have this almost monolith from the media down to through to Downing Street, where you're told what you can object to.
And now to Germany, where recession fears mount as industrial production in Europe's top economy sees an unexpected decline. Official data shows production in manufacturing, energy and construction dropped 3.4% in March compared with the previous month. It swung from an upward increase of over 2% in February. The automotive industry was a major contributor to the recent drop. The automobile sector is a pillar of Germany's economy, and it is hammered by high energy prices following the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. Well, Kiev says Moscow has launched a massive swarm of drones at Ukrainian targets, including the capital. 60 drones were reportedly fired, 36 of them toward Kiev. Ukraine claims it shot all of them down, adding, however, that the debris hit apartments and other buildings, injuring at least 5 people. This has been the largest drone swarm by Russia in months. Moscow made the charge on the eve of the May the 9th holiday, celebrating the defeat of Nazi Germany in 1945. Many expected such an attack, which would be in response to the recent drone strike by Kiev, including the failed attempt on the Kremlin, which Russia said targeted President Putin. This is while fighting rages mainly in Kharkiv, Kherson, Odessa, and Bakhmut, with Russian forces firing rockets at Ukrainian positions. Well, the fifth edition of Export Capabilities of the Islamic Republic of Iran has kicked off in the Iranian capital of Tehran. Hundreds of foreign investors from different countries have participated in this year's event to assess opportunities for cooperation with Iranian companies. Mahdi Abbasian brings us more.
The fifth Export Potential Exhibition of the Islamic Republic of Iran, dubbed Iran Expo 2023, has officially kicked off in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi inaugurated the exhibition. During his speech, Raisi hailed Iran's progress despite sanctions, saying Iranian scientists and industrialists have managed to make great achievements. He also said that the Iranian government has set a 40-year record exporting over $50 billion worth of commodities since August 2021, when his government came into power. Since the early hours of the opening, the exhibition salons were packed with investors and business people from every corner of the world. Representatives from 60 foreign countries have participated in this year's event. The UAE, Pakistan, Russia, Turkey, and China are among the countries taking part in the exhibition. There are a total of 750 domestic companies and representatives at the event that have put their products on display in different industrial, medical, and petrochemical areas, as well as home appliances and food industries. The fifth Export Potential Exhibition of the Islamic Republic of Iran showcases the trade and investment opportunities in the country for foreign businessmen and entrepreneurs. The exhibition will be held from May 7th to 10th. Iranian officials have estimated that the expo will help add more than $2 billion to the country's export revenues. Iran Expo 2023 provides a platform, a perfect platform for investment in non-oil industries of Iran. And the presence of thousands of people in this year's event highlights this fact. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
When Iran and Syria recently inked a series of cooperation agreements, including a long-term strategic pact, the unease and frustration only grew in the power corridors of Washington. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kayhan International wrote in this regard, "It is celebration of victory over the devilish forces of dissension, destruction, and destabilization. The Iranian president's historic trip to Damascus and the red carpet welcome accorded to him by his Syrian counterpart is actually a victory lap for the triumph of the resistance front over not just the most macabrely murderous terrorists, but also their most satanic supporters, especially the U.S. and the illegal Zionist entity. The recent historic meeting in Damascus between honored guests, Dr. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, and the courteous host, Assad, who again expressed his deepest gratitude for Iran's vital role in protecting the prestige and power of Syria, was, however, marked by the conspicuous absence of the main architect of the victory. Yes, the two presidents and their delegations rather felt sad in missing General Qasem Soleimani, a deft diplomat and a brilliant military strategist who was martyred in the most cowardly manner in January 2020 by the vanquished foe, the U.S., whose economic power, military might, sadistic savagery, and satanic sedition miserably failed to bring Syria to its knees. Anyway, so firmly did Soleimani's humanitarian efforts in laying foundations of regional stability in Lebanon, Syria, and other threatened countries included, have proved that today Tehran and Damascus, as backbones of the resistance front, which is fully confident of ending once and for all the Zionist threat, have jointly embarked upon solidifying not just political cooperation and economic industrial construction, but defense potential for the liberation of Palestine. As many as 15 agreements of cooperation in various fields have already been signed on the first day of the visit of President Raisi, who as thanksgiving will pay his humble respects in Damascus at holy shrines of Hazrat Zainab and Hazrat Ruqayyah, peace upon them, Prophet Muhammad's granddaughter and great-granddaughter respectively, in whose defense, along with the native Syrians, many Iranian, Iraqi, Afghan, and Pakistani Muslims achieved immortal martyrdom. President Raisi, hailing Iran-Syria relations as rich, fruitful, and full of experiences, said the mutual ties of the brotherly two countries are tied to the blood of our beloved martyrs, especially General Qasem Soleimani, and this is a key to the stability and strength of the relations between Tehran and Damascus. The two countries have also minced no words in calling for the end of U.S. occupation of some parts of Syria and withdrawal of all American forces from the region. Hopefully, decisively defeated Washing will heed this advice before it is too late. Or else there will be no other choice for the resistance front other than send the uninvited soldiers back to their country in body bags. The Zionist regime, your days are numbered as well, as is evident by the Iranian president's interview recently with Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen TV. The Islamic Republic's power is not a secret to anyone. The Zionist regime's first potential act of folly against Iran would also be its last. Meanwhile, Press TV wrote in this regard, "Be angry and die of anger." Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani tweeted recently, taking a swipe at his American counterpart Vedant Patel using a famous Persian proverb. Patel told reporters in Washington recently that deepening ties between Tehran and Damascus should be of great concern, not just to the U.S. and its allies, but to the world. Of course, the anger of the evil regime whose horn has been broken in Syria and the entire region by Iran and the axis of resistance, and which must end its aggressive presence in Syria, is natural, Kanani wrote in response to Patel's remarks. Why are Americans feeling jittery and peeved over President Dr. Seyed Ebrahim Raisi's visit to Syria? The answer is simple. The U.S. military-industrial complex has faced a disgraceful defeat in Syria after years of propping up terrorist groups and mercenaries with the aim of dislodging President Bashar al-Assad. Recently, as President Raisi touched down in Damascus, 13 years after an Iranian president visited the Arab country last time, he went straight to meet his Syrian counterpart. Assad did not come out of an underground hole like Saddam Hussein, nor was he dragged out of a drain pipe like Muammar Gaddafi. He hosted the visiting official at his beautiful presidential palace. Unlike Saddam and Gaddafi, the Western allies who were eventually dumped, Assad had the backing of Iran and the resistance axis as he stood up to Western powers and their mercenaries. Iran does not betray its friends and allies, which was also acknowledged by Assad recently. You didn't only give us political and economic support, you supported us with your blood, Assad said during his meeting with President Raisi, thanking Iran for its firm and unwavering support. In response, Iran's president lauded the neighboring Arab country for achieving victory in war, despite threats and sanctions, while reaffirming Iran's continued support to Damascus. This is anathema to Americans because they worked so hard and invested too heavy in a project that was designed to overthrow the Assad government and install a Western rubber stamp. The hawks in Washington still haven't given up and live in denial about changing geopolitical dynamics. Arab countries, including U.S. allies, queuing up to normalize their ties with Syria. Patel told reporters recently that Biden administration has made clear to its partners and allies in the region that it does not support normalizing ties with Damascus. A day before, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told his Egyptian counterpart that those engaging with the Assad government should weigh carefully how those efforts are addressing the needs of the Syrian people. As if American airstrikes and pillaging of resources are helping war-weary Syrians. The fact that Washington's Arab allies, including Egypt, have taken a series of measures in recent months aimed at rapprochement with Syria has made Blinken and his absent-minded boss jittery. Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Russia will be meeting in Moscow next week to take the normalization discourse forward, with a focus on restoring full diplomatic ties between Damascus and Ankara. There is already talk about major Persian Gulf economies, including Saudi Arabia, planning to invest in big infrastructure projects in the war-ravaged country as part of reconstruction efforts. Iran has already pledged its assistance to Bashar al-Assad government as it moves to rebuild the country devastated by the decades-long war imposed by the U.S. and its state and non-state allies. Kanani said at his weekly press conference recently, Syria is entering the reconstruction phase and Iran will stand by Syria during this phase too. In his meeting with Assad recently, President Raisi recalled the instrumental contribution of great martyrs, such as General Qasem Soleimani, in freeing the country from the grip of Daesh. Iran-Syria relations are tied to the blood of our dear martyrs, especially Martyr Haj Qasem Soleimani, and this name is the symbol of the stability and strength of the relations between the two countries. Iran's president was quoted as telling Assad, just as the Islamic Republic stood by the Syrian government and nation in the fight against terrorism, it will also stand by its Syrian brothers in the field of development and progress, he said. These remarks, this brotherhood and this camaraderie are a source of alarm for the United States and its allies, as well as the Zionist regime and mercenary groups it has backed in the Arab countries since 2011. That's precisely why Americans are angry, and they have every reason to be so.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
And while we take pride in calling ourselves Shia of Ali, it's not easy to follow the example of Ali. For us, it's easier to look at the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen and look at the qualities that they had and try to at least be like them. Using the phrase from Ziyarat al-Warisa, when we say to the Ashab of Imam Hussein, فَيَا لَيْتَنِي كُنْتُ مَعَكُمْ فَعَفُوزَ مَعَكُمْ, that I wish I had been there with you so that I would have attained the same success as you have attained, the same words we can use for the Ashab of Ali. When we look at the early Shias, we see the name of Salman, Abu Zar, Miqdad, Ammar, and many others. These were the people who were known as the Shias of Ali even during the lifetime of the Prophet. We talked about Salman briefly in the last two lectures, and tonight I would like to talk about the second name in the list of the hadith that sixth Imam says about the 10 levels of Iman, where he puts Abu Dharr on the 9th level after Salman. And so very briefly we will, you know, talk about him and the important, aspects of his life. Abu Dharr al-Ghifari, his name was actually Jundam bin Junada al-Ghifari from the Ghifar tribe. And they lived in the area between Mecca and Sham. He was a person known to be a muwahhid even before Islam, because this tradition of the deen of Ibrahim was still there, although in minority. All the ancestors of the Rasul were all muwahhid. They were not idol worshippers. They are known as those who are following deen of Hanif. It seems that Abu Zar was also one of them, because he never worshipped idols. And in his practical life, he was a righteous person. And when he came to know about the new religion, one of the first things he did was, after making sure that, yes, this is a true story that he's hearing or news, he goes to Mecca during the very early days. And it took him 2 or 3 days to find out, you know, where is this new prophet? Until Ali saw him, and according to the narrations, you know, Ali said, كَأَنَّ الرَّجُلُ غَرِيبٌ. It seems this is a stranger. He's a new person here. So he talked to him, and when he realized that this, he has actually come to look for the prophet, he took him to Rasulullah. Abu Zar actually is considered to be the fourth person among the male who accepted Islam. Historically, we have the name of Ali, and then you look at the name of his brother Ja'far, and then Zayd bin Harisa, the slave of Rasulullah, we come to the name of Abu Zar. And this is very early days where the Prophet had not yet formally, started the mission. And so the Prophet told him that, I advise you to go back to your people. And when the name of Islam and the mission becomes more public, then you can come. So Abu Dhar went back. And eventually, he migrated to Medina and joined the Prophet in Medina and settled down in Medina itself. Salawat upon Akbar. He was not only very highly regarded by the Prophet, but as I said earlier, he is among those who are known to be in the company of Ali, even during the life of the Prophet. And they were known as Shia of Ali. His loyalty to Amir al-Mu'mineen is expressed by that hadith of the sixth Imam, where he says that there were three people who, after the demise of the Prophet, never ever, abandoned Ali. Others were there, but they were a little bit weak. It took them some time to join in. But there were three individuals where him, and those three names basically Salman, Abu Dhar, and Miqdad. These were the people who, not even for a moment, they abandoned Ali. He was there in the house of Fatima, among the 12 people who gathered there as a protest against the Khilafat of Abu Bakr. And he was allowed to be in the janazah of Bibi Fatima and to recite the janazah, namaz janazah with Amir al-Mu'mineen. And so he was very close to Ali. Like Salman, Abu Zar also was a true abd of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These are the people who lived in this dunya, used the blessings Allah had given to them, but they were not slaves of this world. They were the true servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And even the lifestyle, we talked about Salman, he got the position of the governorship of Madain, actually governor of entire Fars, Iran. But he lived a very simple life. When we look at the life of Abu Zar, the same thing. The Prophet actually described Abu Zar in the words where he says, Abu Zar fi ummati shabihu Isa ibn Maryam fi zuhdihi wa wara'ihi. That the example of Abu Zar in my ummah is like somebody like Isa ibn Maryam in his asceticism and abstinence from the luxuries of this dunya. This is Rasul describing Abu Zar as Shabiha Isa ibn Maryam in this ummah. One of the qualities of Abu Zar was that he was very courageous in speaking the truth, never afraid even the presence of the rulers of the time. And the Prophet actually had said, he says, no sky has covered, nor any land has carried anyone more truthful in speech than Abu Zar. This is a very great honor. No sky has covered and no land has, carried anyone more truthful in his speech than Abu Dhar. And so let me, just end by saying that to be a true Shia of Ali is not an easy thing. Shiaism demands loyalty and sacrifice. The example of Salman, Abu Dhar, their lifestyle, their courage in standing up for haq and truth are the things that we have to keep in mind in order to live by the claim that we have that we are the true Shia of Ali bin Abi Talib. That example of Salman and Abu Dhar and other companions should be there. They were ordinary human beings like us. They were not from Anbiya, they are not from Mursaleen, they are not from A'imma, they are not Ma'asoon. Just as the Ashab of Hussein, And if we keep this in mind, inshallah, we'll be able to move in the right direction, inshallah.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In California, United States, a reparations panel has approved a report that could mean billions of dollars for black residents. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. California's Reparations Task Force voted on Saturday, 6th of May, to approve recommendations on how the state may compensate and apologize to black residents for generations of harm caused by discriminatory policies. The nine-member committee, which first convened nearly 2 years ago, gave final approval at a meeting in Oakland, California, to a hefty list of proposals that now go to state lawmakers to consider for reparations legislation. U.S. Representative Barbara Lee, a Democrat from Oakland, who is co-sponsoring a bill in Congress to study restitution proposals for African Americans, at the meeting called on states and the federal government to pass reparations legislation. Reparations are not only morally justifiable, but they have the potential to address long-standing racial disparities and inequalities, Barbara Lee said. The panel's first vote approved a detailed account of historical discrimination against black Californians in areas such as voting, housing, education, disproportionate policing, and incarceration, and others. Other recommendations on the table range from creation of a new agency to approve services to descendants of enslaved people to calculations on what the state owes them in compensation. An apology and an admission of wrongdoing just by itself is not going to be satisfactory, said Chris Lodgson, an organizer with the Coalition for a Just and Equitable California, a reparations advocacy group. An apology crafted by lawmakers must include a censure of the gravest barbarities carried out on behalf of the state, according to the draft recommendation approved by the task force. Those would include a condemnation of former Governor Peter Hardman Burnett, the state's first elected governor, and a white supremacist who encouraged laws to exclude black people from California. After California entered the Union in 1850 as a free state, it did not enact any laws to guarantee freedom for all Californians. the draft recommendation notes. On the contrary, the state Supreme Court enforced the Federal Fugitive Slave Act, which allowed for the capture and return of runaway enslaved people until for over a decade until emancipation. By participating in these horrors, California further perpetuated the harms African Americans faced, imbuing racial prejudice throughout society through segregation, public and private discrimination, and unequal dispersal of state and federal funding, the document says. The task force approved a public apology acknowledging California's responsibility for past wrongdoings and promising the state will not repeat them. It will be issued in the presence of people whose ancestors were enslaved. California has previously apologized for placing Japanese Americans in internment camps during the Second World War and for violence against and mistreatment of Native Americans. The panel also approved a section of the draft report saying reparations should include cash or its equivalent for eligible residents. More than 100 residents and advocates gathered at Mills College of Northeastern University in Oakland, California, a city that is the birthplace of the Black Panther movement. They shared frustrations over the country's broken promise to offer up to 40 acres and a mule to newly freed enslaved people. Many said it is past time for government to repair the harms that have kept African Americans from living without fear of being wrongfully prosecuted, retaining property and building wealth. Elaine Brown, former Black Panther Party chairwoman, urged people to express their frustration through demonstrations. Saturday's task force meeting marked a crucial moment in the long fight for local, state, and federal government to atone for discriminatory policies against African Americans. The proposals are far from implementation, however. There is no way in the world that many of these recommendations are going to get through because of the inflationary impact, said Roy Brooks, a professor and reparations scholar at the University of San Diego School of Law in California. Some estimates from economists have projected that the state could owe upwards of $800 billion, or more than 2.5 times its annual budget, in reparations to African Americans. The figure in the latest draft report released by the task force is far lower, however. The group has not responded to email and phone requests for comment. The Secretary of State, Shirley Weber, a former Democratic Assembly member, authored legislation in 2020 creating the task force with a focus on the state's historical culpability for harm against African Americans, and not as a substitute for any additional reparations that may come from the federal government. Fox News Channel has also covered this story. The state of California's first-in-the-nation reparations task force has voted to approve recommendations for how the state should compensate and apologize to African Americans in response to slavery. The 9-member committee that has been deliberating on the recommendations for 2 years voted in Oakland, California on Saturday, 6th of May. To give its final approval to an extensive report that offers proposals that will then go to the state lawmakers in Sacramento to consider for reparations legislation. The California Task Force recommendations range from creation of a new agency to provide services to descendants of enslaved people to tailored calculations of what the state owes residents for issues like housing discrimination and police brutality. The task force approved a public apology acknowledging the state's responsibility for past wrongdoing and promising the state will not repeat them. It would be issued in the presence of people whose ancestors were enslaved. The committee will meet one more time on 29th of June this year in Sacramento to officially hand over the final report to the state legislature. The task force did not put forward an official price tag, which will be ironed out by the legislature, but experts believe the cost could reach into billions of dollars. The report does include projection restitution estimates and suggestions as to who would qualify for these payments. Economists predicted in a preliminary estimate in March that California's reparations plan would cost the state more than $800 billion. The task force, which consulted five economists and policy experts to arrive at the number, said at the time that the total didn't include compensation for property that the group says was taken unjustly or for the devaluation of black-owned businesses. California's total annual state budget sits at roughly $300 billion. Earlier this week, however, the task force published its latest proposals, which don't contain an overall price tag, but instead outline ways California could calculate how much money black residents have lost since 1850, when the state was established, through to today due to discrimination. Whatever the final figures, it's unclear how California would afford to pay millions of dollars to each eligible black resident of the state. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced in January that the state faces a projected budget deficit of $22.5 billion for the coming fiscal year. Just weeks later, the California Legislative Analyst's Office, a government agency that analyzes the budget for the state legislature, estimated in a subsequent report that Gavin Newsom's forecast undershot the mark by about $7 billion.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei in a meeting with Iranian officials and the ambassadors of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr on April 22nd, 2023. So what should the Islamic world strategy be regarding Palestine? Today, the Islamic world strategy regarding Palestine should be to help the forces inside that country. The resistance front's endeavours are, of course, valuable. Wherever they are, just like us, we too are standing up for the Palestinian issue. The resistance front's endeavours are valuable. These efforts should be focused on strengthening those who are fighting and risking their lives inside Palestine. The last point is the following. We need to truly pay attention to this point. What is the reason for the escalation of the internal struggles in Palestine? It is because of their inclination towards Islam. We had seen what their situation was like before. Back when Islamic tendencies weren't popular among Palestinian groups. Now, some were communists and others were not communists, but they weren't Islamic. These developments did not exist.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
From the time that Islamic tendencies were born in the Palestinian resistance fighters, and from the time this tendency increased on a daily basis, continuing up until today, progress has been made in this manner, in the way the Palestinians fight. So the reason for their success is Islam. Islam. And the enemy has realized this. That's why you see them working against Islam around the world. They are all engaged in fighting Islam. Doing all kinds of things. Of course, their fight against Islam will get nowhere. The Holy Quran states, do they seek to outmaneuver Allah? But it is the faithless who are the ones who are outmaneuvered. The Holy Quran, Surah 52, verse 42. They are making efforts, but the Almighty God will nullify their efforts. This is our duty today. The Islamic Republic recognized this duty from the very beginning. Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah alayh, pioneered this path. He considered the issue of Palestine to be the primary issue, or one of the primary issues, of the Islamic world. This movement started in the Islamic Republic from the time it was formed, and praise God, it is continuing. We hope that our dear nation, our people, and our youth will see the day when Muslims from around the world can freely perform their prayers in Quds. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.